Okay, very good. You've got some nice tables. Looks more like a school now. You have a nice place. That's very good to write things on. Okay, is this working? Yeah, it's working. Okay. So I guess we can just continue. Are you still awake after lunch? Are you all right? Yeah, feeling well? Okay. So we will try to wake you up so see what happens as we go along here. So we'll just continue where we left off before. We were just talking about the Buddha. The Buddha is saying that he has no inner and outer, that he's not handing on the Buddhist teaching to anyone else to be the leader afterwards. And then he continues, and this is the way he continues. So, Ananda, I am now old, worn out, venerable, one who has traversed life's path. I have reached a term of life which is 80. Just as an old cart is made to go by being held together with straps, so the Tathagata's body is kept going by being strapped up, as it were. It is only when the Tathagata withdraws his attention from outward signs and by the cessation of certain feelings and enters into the signless stillness of samadhi of mind that his body knows comfort. Thank you very much, Dennis. Very, very kind of you. Yeah, excellent. We number one upatak. Is that right? Very good. The Buddha then talking again about himself, and you can see here how he talks about the body being worn out, and comparing it to an old cart, right? It's kind of falling apart in a sense, just like the body of an old person tends to fall apart in the same way is the body of the Buddha. And you can see also here he talks about the body being full of painful feelings, and it's only when it enters into this special stillness, a special type of samadhi. This is known as the Animitta Chaito Samadhi in the Pali language. And it's one of these kind of special samadhi that is only attained usually by the Aryas, by the noble ones. And only when he does that, because his mind kind of goes away from the body, only then is the body actually comfortable, is essentially what he's saying here. The signless samadhi of the mind, really, all it really means is a samadhi where you're not paying attention to any particular objects. Almost all the objects of the samadhi cease, so that the mind is basically blank. And for that reason, there's very little feeling left apart from the feeling that has to do with that particular state of samadhi. It's very similar to jhanas and other kind of samadhis, in the sense that you are taken away from the ordinary feelings of the world and the body in particular. So that is just again to kind of emphasize this idea of the Buddha's, the Tathagata's mortality and problems of old age. And then the Buddha says, therefore, Ananda, you should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge with no one else as your refuge. With the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how does the monk live in this way, as an island unto himself, with no other refuge? So before I go on to that, maybe worthwhile just discussing that a little bit, what he's talking about here. You should live as an island unto yourselves. In other words, you should be islands. You shouldn't depend on anything else in this world. You should be as independent as you possibly can, being your own refuge, right? This is, I think, very interesting. It's a very difficult thing to do, of course. The vast majority of people take refuge in all kinds of stuff. And how do you know what you're taking refuge in life? And the way you know that is if you suffer when things become different, when things change and things move in a different direction and you feel a sense of suffering, you know you had refuge in that thing. And I remember just recently we had a lot of Buddhist people in the West, they were really upset by Donald Trump becoming president. No, people didn't really like that, right? And it was funny because people were kind of up in arms and complaining. And the problem, the reason why people complain about these things is because they have a refuge in politics, a refuge in the world. They're hoping that politics will go in a certain direction, that the world will go this way, will go towards more peace, not towards war, towards war equality and more kind of sense of brotherhood and sisterhood in the world, I suppose. And sometimes the world just doesn't go that way because the world is just, by definition, so unreliable, so uncertain. And that is when you know you were taking refuge in the worldly things because you get upset when the world goes in the wrong way. But this is how you find out where your refuge is. But as Buddhists, we should really know that this is not the right place to have a refuge, right? We should be aware, and this is what the contemplation of anicca, impermanence, is all about, is to remind us that we're ready when things really do change. We're ready to accept that and not get so upset when these things happen. If we contemplate anicca in the right way, then whether Donald Trump gets elected president or Mickey Mouse gets elected president, right? It's all the same, because anicca, impermanent, unreliable. And this is kind of what happens with these kind of things. And the same thing with wars, right? We're hoping there won't be any wars in this world because wars are so difficult. We're hoping the political situation will be stable so everybody can be happy wherever they are. We're hoping that we get good leaders in the countries and all of these kind of things. But things are just generally unreliable. And that is, of course, just the external things. And when it comes to the internal things and the private things in life, we have even more of a refuge. Refuge in, family members and our immediate things around us. That's even more strong and even more powerful, the attachments in that area. And again, it's so important to remember that all of these things are, in the end, they are unreliable. They're uncertain. We just don't know what's going to happen. So this is what the Buddha is talking about here, this reminding ourselves of the uncertainty of these things. And then when you do that, you come back to yourself. You sit down in meditation. And this is one of the things that you find out when you meditate, right? When you go inside of yourself, you become peaceful. You feel independent of the worldly phenomena. You feel that you have a strength and a power inside of yourself to withstand things. And this is what this internal refuge is about. The more you go inside of yourself, the more you find happiness and independence from worldly things, the more independent you feel. You feel a strength inside of yourself. And this is what meditation and the practice of the Dhamma can give you when you practice in the right way. One of the qualities of the stream enterer is that the stream enterer is independent of other people in the world. This is one of the qualities, and this is one of the ways you can judge perhaps whether somebody is an Arya or not. How independent are they? How able are they to go their own way without relying on other people? This is one of the qualities of the noble ones. And this is why being an island unto yourself in this way, we will see in a second, is precisely about meditation practice, because that is where you gain that stability inside. And of course, also interesting here is that not just that you are an island or a refuge unto yourself, the Dhamma is also your refuge. Interesting here that the Dhamma is singled now out. Normally we talk about the triple refuge, the triple gem, the Tisarana, but here only the Dhamma. So why? How come we're here talking about the Dhamma here and nothing else? And of course, the context here, I think, makes it clear why we're just talking about the Dhamma. Because the Buddha is about to pass away. It is the wrong time to think about the Buddha in that particular way, because the Buddha is still a person about to die. The Sangha is similar to the Buddha in that it consists of individuals and people who can die. The Dhamma is the only thing which is kind of the teaching that is always there and which is available to you as a refuge in this particular sense. So you can see why the Dhamma here is slightly different. Yeah, so what does that actually mean to take refuge in this way? And of course, what it means is that while we are still practicing, while we're still moving towards the goal, it means that you can attach to these things to some extent. So, you know, while we are meditating, whatever, you may, it's ideally you don't attach to your meditation, you're kind of free from that as well, but it's kind of an intermediate stage. Some degree of attachment is required in this world, because the attachment just comes from our sense of self. As long as we have a sense of self, some degree of attachment is going to be part of what it means to have a sense of self. Because a sense of self has, you have certain qualities inside of you, the sense of self, and has certain belongings that belong to it. And of course, these are the things that we attach to as long as the sense of self is there. So what we're doing here is moving the attachment slightly. Instead of attaching to worldly things, we have a little bit of attachment towards the Dhamma instead. And then eventually moving away from all attachment is the idea. I used to think of the idea of attachment as like climbing a ladder, right? When you climb a ladder, you attach to one rung on the ladder. If you're not attached to the ladder, what happens? You fall off, exactly. You slide off, right? So you have to hold on to those rungs a little bit. And then as you attach to a higher rung, you can let go of the lower ones. And the path is a little bit like that. It's a bit of moving up this ladder called the Dhamma, attaching to something higher, and then letting go of the lower as a consequence. And the strange thing is that as you do that, your grip on the higher ladders actually gets looser as you go up. The attachment actually lessens, because there is a greater sense of ease as you move up this ladder. The more the less developed the mind is, the more firm is the grasp of attachment. So this, I think, so that this idea that the Dhamma here is singled out, not the Sangha and not the Buddha, I think is an important point also now when we think about the triple gem. What are we actually thinking of? And of course, now the Buddha is no longer alive. So now the Buddha is almost like, it's not somebody you can meet in person. So you can't really lose him in the same way. Now the Buddha for us is more like the originator of the path. So when you think of the Buddha, you don't have so much attachment to him as a person, but it's more like this is the being, somebody was there to start with, who actually originated this path. That is a triple gem. Not so much a personal relationship anymore. And the Sangha, in the same way, is really, it's more like a, you know, the real Sangha, the Arya Sangha, is more like a little bit like a theoretical entity. You don't really know who the Aryans are. You know that as long as the path is available, there will be people who make that breakthrough, who actually realize these things. But sometimes it's very difficult to pinpoint who these Aryans are. You may have your feeling that this person, they have the right conduct, they're doing the right thing, maybe they're an Aryan, but it's very hard to actually pinpoint these things. And as long as we attach to individuals, even people we think are Aryans, there's always that danger that we were wrong about this. And then you can often get very disappointed and disillusioned, right? Somebody you thought was a wonderful person, and they end up disrobing, they end up doing something crazy, and you feel very disillusioned as a consequence. So that's why sometimes it's better to know, okay, the Dhamma is here. We know that there is an Aryan Sangha. These people seem roughly right. They're not attached too strongly to any particular individuals. But think of the Sangha in a more kind of amorphous, kind of not very clear sense, a bit kind of diffuse sense, is often a better approach. Whereas the Dhamma, we know what the Dhamma is very clearly here. So this is having the refuge, Dhamma and yourself. And this is how you do it. Here, Ananda, a monk abides, contemplating the body as body, earnestly, clearly aware, mindful, having put away hankering and fretting for the world, and likewise regard to feelings, mind and mind objects. That Ananda is how a monk, or a nun, or a lay Buddhist even, lives as an island unto himself with no other refuge. And you probably recognize that as the four Satipatthanas. The translation here is a little bit strange, I have to admit. I'm not sure about this hankering and fretting for the world. It's rather kind of interesting, but certainly different. But these are the four Satipatthanas, right? So this, of course, is when we get to real meditation practice. And if you want to know what the four satipatthanas are, you can summarize them just simply as mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing fulfills all the four satipatthanas. You don't need anything beyond that. It makes it very simple to know what satipatthana practice is about. I'll have a more detailed look at satipatthana later on in this retreat. That's the plan anyway. We'll see how things go. But just to run you briefly through what is going on here. So you abide contemplating the body as body, kaya kaya nupassi viharati, right? And it's not very obvious what this means. But if you read the Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing, it becomes quite clear what the meaning of this is. Because there what it says that the breath is one body among other bodies. Right? So what this is referring to when it's here is actually, as far as I'm concerned, what it refers to, that you are contemplating a particular aspect of the body. One body in the body. Right, one particular aspect in the body that you're looking at. So I would translate this as he contemplates an aspect of the body. One aspect is the breath. Another aspect is the 31 parts. Another aspect is the four elements, right? Different ways of looking at the body. And then it becomes very clear what is meant. Instead of a body as a body, which is not very clear in my opinion, it could mean many different things, hard to pin it down, but contemplating one aspect of the body, I think, is quite easy to understand. Then we have these other words, earnestly, atapi. This means something like with energy, energetic. You have energy when you do this. Energy of the mind, right? The mind is bright and clear and energetic. This is the ideal way of meditating. For a lot of people, that doesn't happen so often. A lot of time you feel tired, right? Especially if you have a very busy life, you're tired, either that or you're thinking. These are kind of the two things that people normally have problems with, either tired or thinking. One of the two. But very difficult to have that energetic mind, which is just bright and pure. Very similar, this word, to virya, atapi and virya, very similar. Then you have the word clearly aware. This is sampajano or sampajanya, one of these very important words on the Buddhist path, sampajanya, clear awareness. And what that means, basically, is to have clarity about what is going on in the present moment and whether you are actually doing the right thing here. Am I doing the right thing or not? You have clarity about that. Sometimes we talk about mindfulness, and mindfulness is often just about being aware of what is happening now. You know what's going on, right? But it's not enough just to be aware. There's a famous story which Ajahn Brahm tells of the guard of this wealthy woman's house. You know, remember this story? This is a story. Anyway, one of Ajahn Brahm's stories. There's a guard. This wealthy, really wealthy woman has a guard outside her house. And says, okay, guard, I'm going out for the day. Please look after that. Please look after things. And the guard says, yes, ma'am, I've been on a mindfulness course. So I know how to be mindful, right? No problem. And then, of course, the lady goes away. And then during the night, this guard is standing there. And the burglar arrives, right? And the burglar comes, and the burglar kind of picks open the gate. And the guard is mindful, picking open the gate. Walking in, taking television, carrying television out, right? Or stereo, whatever. And then after the night is finished, the lady comes back and says, well, what happened? You know, it's all gone. What happened to all my kind of my valuable possessions and things? Oh, I was really, really mindful. I saw the guard going in, coming out, and all of these kind of things. And then the point of that story, of course, is just the point that mindfulness is not really enough. And this is what is happening here as well. You have to have this thing called sampajana. And sampajana means full awareness or clear comprehension, so you know whether the things is the right things are actually happening here. Okay, I'm now watching the breath, thinking thoughts of ill will, Wait a minute. Okay, clear comprehension kicking in. I'm not supposed to be thinking bad thoughts. Okay, back to the breath again. This is what clear comprehension is about. It tells you whether what you are doing at any particular time is suitable, is purposeful, is leading you in the right direction. That is sampajanya. We can maybe talk a bit more about sampajanya later on, because it's one of these very significant terms again on the Buddhist path. That is essentially what it is referring to here. Then it says there, mindful, after clearly aware, you are mindful, right? So, it sounds kind of obvious, we're talking about mindfulness, so presumably you have to be mindful, but it actually is quite interesting that mindfulness is mentioned there. And the reason why it is interesting is that you will probably know that sometimes Satipatthana is translated as the foundations of mindfulness. I'm sure you have seen that, yeah? But foundation of mindfulness to me means something which allows mindfulness to arise. It is the basis of mindfulness, the foundation of mindfulness. In other words, it is the thing that you rely on for mindfulness to come into existence. Right? Foundation of mindfulness. But actually, what this is saying here, it already says mindful there. So mindful is not what you give rise to by practicing this. What it is saying is that you have to be mindful already to do Satipatthana practice. This is how you do it. It is not the result of the practice. It is actually what you put into the practice from the very beginning. So what this means is that all the other aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, before you come to Satipatthana, those are the things that you have to do for mindfulness to arise. And then when mindfulness has arisen, then you apply that mindfulness, and that is what is called Satipatthana practice. So you have to do these things in the right sequence. If you do them in the wrong sequence, it's not going to work. And this is one of the reasons you may have noticed that when we do the meditation practice here, a lot of it is just to allow the mind to settle down so mindfulness can arise. Yeah, so you settle down, you allow yourself to get into a good mood, having the right attitude. A lot of it is about attitude, because when the attitude is right and you feel happy in the present moment, then mindfulness tends to arise as a consequence. So a lot of the meditation is just to get into the right frame of mind, the right space, forgetting about the past, the busy past week or whatever it is, so that now you can really kind of get into the present moment. Then, when mindfulness has arisen, then you can do Satipatthana. Then you can watch the breath. Then you can do all these other things. Get things in the wrong order, and it's going to be very hard to do the meditation practice. You're going to put too much force into it, too much of all these other things, and then it becomes quite unpleasant as a consequence. Okay. I shouldn't really go into too much detail about these things now, because we're probably getting a little bit too far astray. But so clear mindfulness and having put away hankering and fretting for the world. What is that? Hankering and fretting for the world. Sometimes they have other translations that are equally dodgy. They have another one, a really dodgy one, is the one where having put away, you're having given up, covetousness what is the other word? Covetousness and grief. Grief, right? Grief is what you do when somebody in your family dies. Then you grieve, right? This has got nothing to do with when somebody in your family dies at all. This is a completely different kind of thing here. So it's so important to get the right words in there. So what is meant by this is that it is your reaction to the world around you, especially the reaction to the sensory impressions that we have. And the reactions that we have to sensory impression usually is either we like the sensory impression, right? So desire, if you like, desire, or we dislike them, aversion. So a good translation here would be having put away desire and aversion in regard to the world. Or having put away like and dislike in regard to the world. Those are both, in my opinion, acceptable translations. And they are just a little bit easier to understand than fretting and hankering for the world. Which I have no idea where he got those words from. Some kind of ancient dictionary from the 19th century or something, maybe. So it is very... And the world here, the world that probably means just the five senses. Sometimes the word of the Buddha, the word world has a very wide range of meanings, and this is one of the meanings that it has. So that is what the Satipatthana is about. So You can see here the very fact that you have put away desire and aversion for the world means that you are already quite detached from the world. Attachment to the world means that we have desire and aversion for things. So this is what it means to be detached to some extent. And that is why the Buddha calls this having nothing else as your refuge. Only the Dhamma, only yourself as a refuge, because you have given up that desire and attachment. When you don't have that desire and attachment, much easier to do your meditation practice, because you can just observe without being drawn into the object by desire or aversion. Okay, if you have any questions about all of these things I'm saying, please write them down and we can interrogate me tonight or tomorrow or whatever, and we'll see what happens at that stage. And then we have the same thing, so that was just the body. We have the same about feelings, certain feelings among feelings, certain mind states or mind qualities, the citta here, and mind objects, Dhamma, maybe principles or maybe causality or something like that, mind objects. We'll have a greater look at this later on when we get to the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is how you live as an island unto yourself with no other refuge. And then the Buddha says, and those who now in my time and afterwards live in this way, they will become the highest if they are desirous of learning. Learning should be training, really, rather than learning. If they are desirous of training, sikkha kama means desirous of training here. The idea here seems to be that if you desire to train, if you practice in the right way, then you will get the highest results as a consequence. That basically seems to be what the Buddha is talking about there. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. I'm going to drink a little bit of coffee before the coffee goes colder. I apologize. I recognize none of you have got any coffee. That's terrible, isn't it? You have. Okay. You're very wise, Bob. You've got your own little thing there. Okay, good. Okay, let us move on to the next paragraph. So now again, we are jumping a little bit. Jumping forward, you see the little dots there. So just taking out some of these passages. Ananda, have I not told you before all those things that are dear and pleasant to us must suffer change, separation and alteration? So how could this be possible? Whatever is born, become compounded and liable to decay, that it should not decay, this is impossible. Right? One of those standard things that you see in the suttas, whatever is dear and pleasing to us must become otherwise, must change. This is one of the famous, one of the five contemplations the Buddha recommends us to do all the time. This is one of those contemplations. And that things, everything dear and beloved to us must change and become otherwise. And it's interesting that here he has to tell Ananda, even Ananda again, as I mentioned before, who is a stream mentor, has to be reminded of this, right? And you can see how deep-seated some of these attachments actually are. And we need to remind ourselves of these things. And when you remember that, what actually happens when you remember these things? What happens is that you undermine a little bit the desires and the attachment for the worldly phenomena. This is what happens. And when you do that, when you undermine the desire and attachment a little bit, it means that you have more clarity of mind. You see better what you're supposed to be doing and what you're not supposed to be doing. Right? There's many different types of intoxication and lack of clarity. And one of the important ones is the lack of clarity that comes from attachment and desire to those things that are agreeable and likable to us. So just by remembering that, we get a bit of clarity. And when you get a bit of clarity, you know more what is the right way to practice. You know, remind yourself to do what is good in the world, to do what is right, and to avoid those bad things. There's a quite a nice sutta which I have not included here. I don't think I have included anyway. I can't remember what I included anymore. There's so many suttas in here. Let's but let's have a, I'll have a quick look, see if I have included it. I don't think so. No. Oh, maybe too many suttas. I'm not sure what to do with it. We'll be in trouble. Okay, I don't think it's there. So, and this is the sutta where, this is the sutta with King Pasenadi and Queen Mallika. This is called the Piyajataka Sutta, born from those who are dear, found in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. I think it's number 87. And this is the sutta where Mallika says to her husband, Mallika is the queen, King Pasenadi is her husband, right? He says to her husband that the Buddha has said that sorrow and sadness comes from people who are dear to you. Right? And then King Pasenadi, the king, gets really upset. What do you mean? He can't say that. Everybody knows that it is joy and happiness that comes from those people that are dear to you. Right? That's what most people think, right? Oh, yes, all of these people are so close to me. All I get is happiness and joy from these things. And as usual, the Buddha tends to turn things a bit upside down and looks at things in a different way. So he gets really upset with his queen Mallika, and then the queen decides to show him that this is the case, right? So she goes to the Buddha, or she sends someone to the Buddha, and asks the Buddha to explain what is going on. And then the Buddha says, well, if somebody in your family, and it lists a large number of different people, if they die, what happens? How do you feel? Do you feel sad or do you feel happy? Feel terrible, feel sad, right? If somebody in your life gets really sick, somebody in your family gets really sick, what do you feel about that? I feel terrible again. And it goes through this long list, right? And eventually, kind of that person who goes to listen to this gets the point and goes back to the palace. And then Queen Mallika tells the king, well, this is how it works, right? If your son, Prince Vidudaba, if he got sick, how would you feel? And the king says, terrible! I feel absolutely awful! That's what the Buddha means when he says that those who are dear to you, they are, that's the cause for suffering and problems in life. And then she goes on like that with all the important people in the king's life and shows that ultimately each one of them have to die, they have to get sick, they have to disappear. So there is there a cause for suffering. Piyajataka, born, suffering born from those who are dear. Right? It's a beautiful way of remembering that. What the Buddha is not saying, it's important to get the right nuance here, because it doesn't mean that it is just suffering, right? People who are dear to us is just suffering and nothing else. Because if that was the case, we wouldn't have any dear ones at all. We would just kind of strike it out, leave out, walk into the forest and disappear by ourselves and never meet anyone again. But that's not really the right way either. The point is that there's a middle way here. There is some extent to which people are dear to us, and it leads to a degree of happiness and suffering. Of course, if that wasn't the case, we would never get married, we would never have any children, we wouldn't have any friends, right? We'd just go to a cave quickly and stay in that cave from now on. So there is some happiness there, but we tend to forget the suffering that also comes from these kind of relationships. There's always two sides to these things. There has to be departure. There has to be separation one day. And just remembering that, it kind of gains a bit of clarity. It doesn't mean we get a divorce straight away, right? That's also the wrong kind of takeaway message from that. But what it means is that we have a sense of clarity about these things. We remember that. And when you remember that, you can stand back and see things more clearly. And when you do that, you have more ability to be kind, to be patient, to be reasonable in life, rather than actually being carried away by things. So this is what it means to remind yourself, everything dear and beloved to me must become otherwise. It is a thing that the Buddha says we should reflect on very often. Many of the teachings of Buddhism are like that. They are very simple teachings, but they only go deep down when you reflect on them again and again and again. It takes time, right? I'm sure most of you have heard this kind of teaching before, but how deep has it gone? How well do you know it? And this is really the question here. And if it goes very, very deep, of course, that's when it starts to have a real effect on your life. But it makes you more happy as an individual. It doesn't make you cold, doesn't make you uncaring. It makes you better as an individual when you have a little bit more distance rather than being too caught up with other people and all these things in our life. So the Buddha here reminding Ananda of this, right? It's a very very interesting, and shows how deep-seated these things actually are. Yeah. And then he says, the part that I have skipped here before is where the Buddha renounces the life faculty and says that he will attain Parinibbana in 3 months' time. And this is what he's referring to next here. And that has been renounced, given up, rejected, abandoned, forsaken. The Tathagata has renounced the life force, the Ayu Sankara, I think it is here, or the Jivita Sankara, something like that. So, in other words, these things are compounded. The Buddha is compounded himself, so he also will have to pass away here. And now it will happen because he's given up the life force. The Tathagata has said once and for all that the Tathagata's final passing away will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take final Nibbana. That the Tathagata should withdraw such a declaration in order to live on is not possible. Now come, Ananda, we will go to the gabled hall in the great forest. Very good, Lord. So the idea here is that when the Buddha has said something, then it is he has said it for a reason, and it's not going to turn it around again afterwards. So that, in other words, the Buddha, he acts on facts, and there's no real reason for him to turn things around again afterwards, presumably. Yeah. So he's driving home the point that even the Buddha is impermanent, even the Dhamma is impermanent, right? How long is the Dhamma going to be around before it disappears from this world? Ooh, scary. And then you kind of you get on with it, right? And you practice. And this is what happens when you remember these things. Things are impermanent. And the Lord went with Venerable Ananda to the gabled hall in the great forest. When he got there, he said, Ananda, go and gather together all the monks living in the vicinity of Vesali and get them to come to the assembly hall. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and did so. He then returned to the Lord, bowed down to him, stood to one side and said, Lord, the order of monks is gathered together. Now is the time for the Lord to do as he sees fit. So again, here, the Buddha getting all the monks together. And of course, the idea here must be that there is an important message. That's why he wants to give it to the whole Sangha, not just the Venerable Ananda. So now you can assume that this is something that is to be learned and remembered for after the Buddha's passing away. Then the Lord entered the assembly hall and sat down on the prepared seat. Then he said to the monks, Monks, those matters which I have discovered and proclaimed should be thoroughly learnt by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated, so that this holy life may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit and happiness of devas and humans. And what are those matters? So here the Buddha is going to tell us, right? He's talking here about those matters that he has discovered. And the Pali word for this is abhinya, and abhinya can also be translated as having insight into, that he has seen for himself. Right, so this is the actual discovery of the Buddha, the things that he has seen through his awakening experience. And after discovering these things, he has learnt them, he has proclaimed them to the Bhikkhu Sangha. So of course, what we're talking about here then is the essence of the Buddha's discovery here, the essence of what the Buddha's teaching is all about, the things that actually matter so that these things can be upheld for future generations. And people, if you ask them what those things are, the people would often guess, oh, probably means the Four Noble Truths, right? The Four Noble Truths is this essence of what the Buddha taught. And, of course, the Four Noble Truths are one important teaching in Buddhism. And in certain suttas, they are kind of put to the fore as being the container within which all other teachings fit. So they're certainly important. But the interesting thing here is that the Buddha does not talk here about the Four Noble Truths. He talks about something else. And these are the things that should be learned by you, practiced, developed, and cultivated. In fact, when you see those words, practiced and developed, it gives you some idea what these things are. And they are the four foundations, again, four focuses or applications of mindfulness. The four right efforts. The four aspects of spiritual power. The four spiritual faculties. The five mental powers. The seven factors of awakening. And the noble eightfold path. These are those things that should be learned by the monks and then practiced and cultivated afterwards. So, what are these particular things that you are seeing here? And some of you may recognize these things. These are known as the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas in later Buddhism. And in Bodhipakya means those things that are on the side of awakening. So these are all the practical aspects of the Buddhist path. All those things that we're supposed to do to give rise to awakening. The 37 factors that basically bring awakening around. 37 aids to awakening, it says here, is the later kind of a vocabulary that is used for this. So all of this is our pragmatic teachings about practice, about what we have to do. That is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. That is what he is saying here. So what are these 37? They look like quite a complicated list, right? Do we have to remember all of that? Too much to remember, some people would say. Basically, they can be summarized as the Noble Eightfold Path. All of these things together come together in the Noble Eightfold Path. And then the Noble Eightfold Path can in turn be summarized as the things we were looking at early on today. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. They can be summarized as that. And then that summary again of the Noble Eightfold Path or Sila, Samadhi, Panya, that can be expanded into the gradual training, which we're going to have a look at probably tomorrow or something. Probably coming up tomorrow, I think. Yeah. That is the expansion of that. So you can see how these things can be contracted down, expanded in different ways of looking at the same thing. And all of those are equally valid ways of looking at this path. So let's have a quick look at these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. They are so important, right, that the Buddha singles them out as the thing that should be remembered and practiced. The first thing, maybe before I talk about that, is just to point out that this important thing about thoroughly learning these things, sadukang ugahitva, or uganhati, is thorough learning. So you had to learn these things thoroughly, right? And of course, at the time of the Buddha, that would have meant reciting these things. They talk about group recital in many other places. And of course, group recital is a way to ensure that the teachings are stable and they are kept for the future. Because when you recite together in the group, if one person gets it wrong, the average in the group will be okay, and it will remind those people who got it wrong. And this is how the suttas were kept stably in the early days while there still was oral recitation of the suttas. So you learn them thoroughly. And then, of course, because these are practical, pragmatic teachings, the next thing you do is to practice them. And this is one of those important things. They have to be practiced, developed, and cultivated. Right? Why is that so important? And it is important because it is only when you cultivate these things fully and you actually realize them for themselves, that is when they become truly stable. Once you have seen these things, once you know what they are in your own heart, not just lip recital, not just kind of parroting what the Buddha said, but actually seeing them inside of yourself, that is when these things become really stable and solid, and there is no doubt anymore about the interpretation of what these things are. So the Sangha should practice these things. If you don't practice them, then they are liable to get lost, and not, you probably won't be able to pass them on to future generations. So learn, then practice, and then you realize these things. It is also interesting to note here that this is the path, right? In what sense can it be said that you realize the path? How can you know that the path is correct? How can you realize that? You might be able to understand how you can realize that everything is suffering, right? By watching your body, by investigating your body after samadhi, when your mind is very still, and you investigate, you can see that everything is impermanent. You can sort of understand how that's possible, right? Because seeing things impermanent just means that you see them kind of coming into existence and passing away here. You can sort of understand that. But how can you have insight into the path? That seems a bit strange. And I think the way to understand that is that what you understand when you become a stream enterer, when you see that craving, when you see that everything is, five khandhas are suffering and all of that, what you see is the kind of mind that is necessary for attaining stream entry, for having insight. You understand for the first time the kind of mind that is required. And that kind of mind is a mind completely pure, without any kind of defilements, a mind that has been strengthened by the samadhi practice, that has very powerful qualities to it, has the upeka which is just watching on without being influenced by desire and aversion, just watching in a very peaceful and very natural way. Right? A mind which is joyful and is very strong because of the joy and happiness in it. Has the upeka, has the stability of samadhi, is extremely calm and peaceful. You can keep that light, that watching, keep it going, 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 without ever really being distracted. So you understand the quality of mind that is required. And when you understand the quality of mind, you understand also the practice. You understand the importance of sila, because if you don't have sila, the mind is not going to be pure. You understand the importance of thinking in the right way. If you don't think in the right way, again, the mind is not going to be pure, right? You understand the power of meditation, because it empowers the mind. It gives it the joy and the happiness and the steadiness that will enable you to break through to these kind of things. And this is how you, I think, you understand the path as part and parcel of the Four Noble Truths. So let us have a look at these 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. I'm going to give you a test at the end to see if you remember these names. Can you? Bodhipakkhya Dhammas? No, there's no test, right? I'm just being naughty. So, first of all, the four. No, don't like foundations. Don't want foundations. I want other focuses. Focuses, or maybe, what is the other word I was saying before? I forgot that word already now. Applications. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. You are really good students. I'm very impressed. Four applications of four focus of mindfulness, right? So, what is this? Well, this is, again, just the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? That's really all it is. So it goes, you can see it as an aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. The four right efforts, of course, another aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. The sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The four steps to spiritual power, the four Iddhipadas. That also is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. It's part of the samadhi aspect, because how you actually attain samadhi and stillness of the mind. The five spiritual faculties, these are the faculties, these are the abilities that you attain when you become an Aryan. That is when all these faculties become stabilized, because your faith, your confidence in the teaching become stabilized, and because they are stabilized, the other faculties too become stabilized. The five mental powers are just an aspect of that. So this is a certain way of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path once you become a stream enterer, once you become an Arya. That's what that really is about. And the seven factors of awakening, which is the second last one there, that is an expansion of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, an expansion of Sammasati and Sammasamadhi. It shows you the process that happens from doing the Satipatthana all the way to the highest aspects of Samadhi. So all of this, you can see, they're really just comes together in the Noble Eightfold Path, the different aspects, different ways of remembering what the Noble Eightfold Path is about. That's really all it is. So these are the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. And perhaps you will ask, what about the Four Noble Truths? What about the Four Noble Truths, right? They're not there. How can't we have Buddhism without the Four Noble Truths? Any ideas? Four Noble Truths? Where are the Four Noble Truths? The Four? Buddha's power? Maybe not, perhaps, yeah? That's maybe not the most obvious place. Okay, it's in the right view, right? The first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. That's where you find the Four Noble Truths. Because right view is all about how we approach reality, how we look at the world. And that is basically the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is what we want to get insight into. So it's an aspect of the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's there, right? So, okay, we just save the Four Noble Truths from oblivion. Otherwise, we might have to kind of erase them because they're not actually part of the core teachings. But there, we have them after all. I'm very glad to be able to say that. Otherwise, we might have to reconsider the entire Buddhist dispensation, which would be a lot of hard work. So what about dependent origination then? Dependent origination is not there either, right? There's no dependent origination there. Yeah, from the Four Noble Truths, yeah, that's exactly right. So in the Four Noble Truths, right, the second Noble Truth and the third Noble Truth, the second one is dependent origination in forward order. That's all, it's expanded like that. And the third Noble Truth is dependent origination in the cessation order. It is when all the things ceases, one after the other, and leads eventually to the eradication of suffering as a consequence. Forward order is when you have avidya, the ignorance at the beginning, right? Or delusion at the beginning. And that delusion through all the steps via craving, that's the important one, via craving leads to suffering as the final step. That is equivalent to the second Noble Truth, craving leading to suffering. Third Noble Truth is the destruction, the ending of that avidya delusion at the bottom. You end that, and then through that, craving ends, which is the Third Noble Truth, and because of that, suffering ends at the very end. Yeah? So you can see how neat this all is. It all fits together very beautifully. All the factors actually are there. And things that you may have thought of as dry theoretical teachings like dependent origination or the Four Noble Truths or whatever, actually, they too are part and parcel of the path because it has to do with our outlook, how we look at the world, falls into the idea of right view and right way of seeing things. Yeah, so it's all part there. So we have also saved dependent origination from oblivion. We are doing really well. If there's any other teachings that need to be saved, then write them down on a piece of paper, and I will see if we can save them tonight before it's too late, and see what happens with that. So my point is just that it is really all. The Buddhist teachings are very pragmatic, and even those things that may seem theoretical, actually, they're also part of the practice in a very real sense. Okay, so there you are. These are the core teachings of the Buddha, right? The things that he said that we should look after, that we should remember, that we should practice fully. So please remember that, because it is a very, very useful way of thinking about this. So let us do maybe a little bit more before we have a break. Then the Lord said to the monks, "And now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things, these asankaras, are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. The Tathagata's final passing will not be long delayed. 3 months from now, the Tathagata will take his final Nibbana." These are the famous words that the Buddha also says on his deathbed towards the very end. All conditioned things have the nature to decay. Vaya Dhamma Sankara, right? Vaya Dhamma Sankara. And then strive on untiringly afterwards. Appamadena Sampadeta. The famous last words of the Buddha. Yeah. Okay, so then we are actually moving on to a slightly different topic. So I think we will probably good to stop there. But it's actually interesting the way the Buddha here, in a sense, this is his final advice before his passing away, right? All conditioned things are of a nature to decay. So in a sense, that is also another summary of the Buddha's teachings. And just sometimes all we need to do is to remember some of these very simple summaries. And by remembering some very simple summaries like that, we can go a very, very long way on the Buddhist path. All sankharas are of nature to decay. And what are these sankharas? What are these conditioned phenomena? Everything is these conditioned phenomena, right? When you look into the world, when you look at yourself, internally, externally, everything is part of these conditioned phenomena. And this is kind of the problem. And of course, the idea here is to remind you that you cannot rely on any of these things. Because they are conditioned, once the conditions change, then the phenomenon itself will change as a consequence. You cannot rely on anything. So just that memory, that recollection that things are always subject to decay, always subject to change, is enough for you to be mindful, to be clear, to know what you have to do, not to be intoxicated, not to be stupid, not to waste your life with silly things, but to be clear about the Dhamma and practice in the right way. So very powerful and simple advice. And there are certain kind of a number of things like that in the Dhamma, which is very powerful and simple advice. The most powerful advice of all that I like to give people is to always remember to get spiritual input in your life. Because even this one here, Vaya Dhamma Sankhara, even that kind of thing, after a while you forget about it, right? Yes, you know it is important, then you forget about it. So how can we ensure that we always remember at least some of the very basic teachings? And the answer to that is one of those very foundational factors of the Buddhist path. That is to remember to always to get some spiritual input in your life. Right, on a regular basis, because that spiritual input reminds you of what the Dhamma is all about. It keeps your view straight. It keeps you on the straight and narrow, right? No messing around. You don't kind of go too far this way or that way. You do what you need to do. And life is so busy. If we don't have that regular spiritual input, we tend to forget. Even in monastic life, sometimes you forget, right? Let alone in lay life, when there are so many distractions. So this, I think, is one of the most important things. Read a sutta now and again. Hear a nice Dhamma discourse, right? Whenever you feel that you're losing track of your Buddhism, go back to the basics. Go back to a Dhamma discourse. Remind you of the basics. What are those basics? Things like this. Vaya Dhamma Sankhara, or just to be kind, right? One word, kind, is really all you need often on the Buddhist path. And when you have those simple things, then you will make progress really fast. And you will get all the good things that result from the Dhamma as a consequence. Okay, let's have a break. We'll see you back again in 15 minutes.